Welcome to Everyday Leadership, the podcast where we go beyond the titles to explore the truth behind what it means to lead with intention, authenticity, and impact. And today's guest is someone who ticks all those boxes. She is an award-winning social entrepreneur, and I'm going to call her a powerhouse when it comes to leadership and transformation. Avra Grant is the founder and CEO of A Vision, where it's a pioneering organization that has impacted, I think, over 6,000 lives through your various programs, leadership courses, community interventions that you've done. And under Avra's leadership, they've partnered with schools, businesses, criminal justice sector, just to look at reducing youth violence, boosting employment, and saving millions for the UK taxpayer. Her work is all about igniting self-belief, strengthening resilience, creating pathways for young people, ex-offenders, and professionals who are seeking lasting career success. She has shared this through her TEDx. She's a TEDx speaker. She's a visionary businesswoman because she does a number of different things that we're going to delve into. But more importantly, she's someone that say who proves that being a purpose-driven entrepreneur can transform lives, communities, and can change the narrative of what it really looks like when you're being intentional. Avril, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. What a wonderful introduction. Thank you.
It's an absolute pleasure. You're someone I always look forward to talking to. There's so much. Every single time we have a conversation, we always lead into different bits and pieces. And I was thinking for this podcast, where do I want to start? I'm going to start where I generally start with most of them, I think. If I met you at the age of 10, what would I have seen glimpses of in the person I'm talking to now?
Wow, what a question. Thank you. Something very significant happened in my life at age 10, actually. So I'll talk to you just, it's funny that you should actually mention that age. I'll talk to you about when I hit 10 and then when I was 10, what actually happened. So the type of person that I was at 10, I think I was always adventurous, definitely. I loved playing out. It was proper playing out days, you know, when kids used to play out and say,
good times.
Real time, absolutely. Playing out, you'd be one of those. I was always out on my bike, roller skates, you know, I was quite a happy child in that respect. Very much a seeker of adventure, that kind of thing. I wanted to learn. I loved to learn. So that hasn't really changed within me. But then something happened when I was 10 years old. So I used to live in a very racist area in Birmingham called King Standing, particularly the Wiley Birch. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that area. And in that area, when I was around 10, what happened was there were a family there, a big family that would target black families, in particularly, and there would be racist signs around, very visible, there'll be swastika signs, there'll be NF signs, literally in your face. When you come out of your door, on the wall in front of you, you will see these signs. So it's very clear that we weren't very welcome, but we were one of five black families in this area. And they would just target quite a few of the families, and us being one of them. And it got to the stage where our family would be coming, say, out of their homes, going to work, be taunted. I would go to school, I'd have bottles rolled under my feet, I'd be spat at, I'd be called names. They couldn't work out whether I was black or whether I was Asian or both, or they would call me nigger, they'll call me paki, they'll call me anything and everything. And that was a lot of the life there. In that area. And then what happened was the crescendo happened when we were watching, I'll never forget, Family Fortunes. And a series of things happened before this point. So for instance, my mom's car got burnt to a crisp. One morning we'd smell burning and we're thinking, well, it's not in the house. Where is it coming from? We'd look outside and my mom's car is a carcass and it's still steaming. It would be that kind of thing. And they'll be laughing, drinking around the car, that kind of thing. It would be, you know, I could tell you so many different incidents that happened before it got to the crescendo. So my auntie It's quite sad, but she was assaulted by the. My mom came out with a walking stick. I do talk about this on the TEDx talk, actually. It's quite heart-hitting. It's unforgettable. But the crescendo happened when we were watching Family Fortunes in the living room. Me, my mom, my uncle, who's like a brother to me, and my auntie, and we're watching this program. Normal day, and all of a sudden, I found myself on the floor. That's all I can say. I found myself on the floor. There was like a piercing of like glass or singing sensation underneath my palms, and I could feel that, but I'm still on the floor and I'm face down. And then you could hear the echo of a bang afterwards, and you could hear them running off and laughing. So we're on the floor, and I'm waiting for this massive smoke in the living room to dissipate because you can't see anything. You can just feel the glass, and you know you're on the floor. When this black smoke started to dissipate, I saw my mum on the floor, everybody on the floor. And my auntie had blood on her face. And my mum said, "Everybody okay?" We couldn't even speak. We just didn't even know what happened. Then when we actually eventually found the words, we said, "Look," and we looked up, and there was bullet holes all around the clothing. So it's like a paint gun. So yeah, it was quite an experience, and I think it kind of shaped my life in terms of just injustice, experiencing it firsthand. Yeah, and they ran out laughing. And the council's answer to this was, get the black families out. They didn't know how to actually deal with this situation. We were all over the news. We were all over the Gleaner, which is Jamaican newspaper as well. We were everywhere. I had 24-hour security, so I'd have to be escorted to and from school, to the shops, everywhere. It was intense, really intense at that stage. And then we had an emergency move because, as I said, the answer. From the council's perspective, we get the black families out there causing problems, which is
Ridiculous.
just shows what, yeah, it really was. And so we were moved up the road to another part of the same area. But yeah, that was the experience at 10 years old that I'll never forget. Yeah, I'll never forget.
You said it shaped you and shaped how you look at things. In what way?
I really experienced, not only racial violence, racial discrimination, but the whole injustice, and that it really bothered, it really stayed with me. Like, how, and why would you? I couldn't relate it. Oh, it was something that was going on in my mind. Like, why would you do such a thing? I couldn't understand it. And like, how our subconscious mind starts asking it questions, it starts searching for the answers. And I just couldn't find the why. I couldn't comprehend why you would want to do such a thing. And so I wanted to support people to transform. And it didn't matter who they were, whether they were the perpetrators of what happened there, or others. I wanted to share with people that, that they can change, they can change. That is not the way. That is not the way to go. So, and it's just not the way to live. I wanted them to know they could think big, and it didn't matter who they were. As I said, it could be, our perpetrators, it could be anybody, but I wanted to be able to make a difference. But also, I think seeing the suffering in my community as a whole, and that can be economically, in various different ways, we weren't achieving what I knew we could. And I saw what was impacting that, and I wanted to do something about empowering us as a community, having us overcome, these kinds of traumas that do happen that are unfortunately normalized as well. Me having that experience, being one of them. But how can we empower ourselves? How can we achieve what we know we're capable of? How can we do this? Yeah, I wanted people to not think about what is, but think about what could be.
Not just focus on your current reality, but thinking about the future as well.
That's it. And I think a lot of us would just couldn't stop thinking about what currently was, which is understandable, but I wanted us to think about what could be, just really thinking about having a vision, you know, for yourself. So, yeah.
So at that age, you're a young teenager, you're navigating, obviously you had that experience from when you were 10, you're still navigating that, you still have those thoughts already starting to grow in your mindset. Before you turn 19 and things changed for you, was there something you had in mind around what it is that you wanted to achieve? I'm curious, even as a teenager when you were at school, where you were like, what can I do to make a difference or impact? Were you thinking about that at all like that?
No, at that stage, I didn't really pin it down. I was still trying to navigate myself and my own journey. It wasn't necessarily about others then, until I went through what I went through at 19 and I started to really think about more others. But around 19, I just wanted to make mom proud. I just wanted to literally make her proud. I think having that experience and then mom putting me into the school that she did, which was a private school, as a single mom, she really wanted the best for me and my sister, and therefore she really, yeah, she did. And she wanted us to not have what happened to, you know, impact to the point where we, you know, we wouldn't really progress. So she wanted us to be in a great environment and a great environment in terms of schooling as well. So we were put into a private school, and I'll be honest, I hated it. I absolutely hated every bit of it. And from going from year 7 to year 9, I absolutely, because it was, we were the minority again, and we were singled out again, and it felt like the same kind of dynamic that it took a while to get used to. I was blamed for everything that wasn't my fault. I was the only black, you know, person in the whole of my year, so we were the full minority. It was tough. And then in year 9, I had to buckle down and make sure I got these results to make my mum proud. So I think in that stage, I was just focused on making mum proud and giving her a return on her investment. Because she
You see
reminded
it, you can
me
see
every day.
she spent, listen, I'm the same with my kids when because they went to private school. Like, I want some ROI on this because I could be living my best life with the money I'm spending in private school. So I can completely relate and kind of understand that. And I guess that's why, I guess at 19, when you turned pregnant and had your son, that was why it was such a big thing with you and your mum, because it's like, put you in the best school, trying to create the best environment for you, and this is what happened. That must have been quite tough for you to just deal with that at that stage, wasn't it?
It really was. You had to grow up really, really quickly. And as I was saying, like, I'm from a family of very strong, black, matriarchal, independent women. And so I had to make it work. I made the decision and I had to make that work. And if that meant I had to leave the family home, I had to leave the family home and I had to make this work. I had to really grow up in a very short space of time. And I, you know, I've seen my nan, my mom do things on her own. So I knew that I could, but it didn't take away from the scariness of it, especially when you haven't got anywhere to live. So there I was with my huge, you know, stomach at the time, my bum. I loved my bum, honestly. And I enjoyed every bit of it. I really did. I really did. Me, my bum. And so it was us. It was us. I always say to my son now, it's us against the world, son. I say it, I only laugh, but I really mean it. It's just me and you against the world. And it always has been. So even when I was kicked out, I went to the neighborhood office with my black bags. I was there all day until they gave me a hostel, as it were. You know, it's what happens, that's the process. And you know, I've been into four different hostels, moved around quite a lot. Thankfully, I drove, so I'd, you know, go and see friends in the daytime, go and sleep at the hostel. It's that kind of a thing. But sleeping in that hostel, you heard things, you saw things. You know, it wasn't a great, you know, experience. But I taught, sorry, I learned so much in that environment. Just hearing what I heard and knowing what people were going through. You know, the different kinds of people that were, you know, less fortunate than myself. You know, living in those. environments as well. So after the hostels, I then had a temporary accommodation, and then you get your permanent kind of accommodation, your own flat, which is like the big win. Like, you've got your own place that you can call your own. So it took a while, it really did, but I had to go really, really quickly, go through the whole birth, all of those. And my mum did come to the birth. She made sure I didn't die. That was a thing. She made sure I didn't die because it was, you never know how it can go. And that was it. Had my son, and there he would never know that we were in hostels. As in, he would never remember it. He'd be in the car chair, it'd be that kind of a thing. And his smile would just keep me going. As I said, it was me and my son against the world. Yeah, his smile, his gummy, it just kept me going. Put a rocket under your backside, really, to make it work.
How do you not get angry or bitter? Like when I hear you describe the scenario now, it's very much like come from a matriarchal environment, you've got to make it work and figure things out. I made the choice, made a decision, I'm just going forward and forward and forward. Yeah, you see so many times when situations and setbacks happen in people's lives and it just kind of knocks them back, or they get angry, they get bitter, they get resentful, they blame everyone else around you. It's like, even like my mom's supposed to be there for me, all these different elements and stuff like that. How is it that you did not lean into that side of things and instead you went the complete opposite?
No, it's a really good question. I didn't realize I was living in a state of trauma until probably in my 30s. Seriously, when I look back, when you're on survival mode, you put feelings to the side. So I didn't really think about, the hostile environment, or the relationship between me and my mother. And I think subconsciously it was there, but I didn't really process it and let it eat me up. I knew it wasn't ideal, but I knew that I was enough. Like, we'll be good. Like, in my head, we will be absolutely fine, and I'll make sure of it. And because that's the goal, and that is the vision, there's nothing else can get in the way, of that vision. My son was the one that was motivating me, and that's all I needed. So that was it. I didn't have time to really think about all the negatives. It would just take away from the goal. So you just go on survival mode and you make it happen. And and I did. There's no other way. There is no other way. There's no plan B because it's distraction plan A. That's how it goes. That's how it goes.
And they end up to, like you said, you got temporary accommodation, you started to work, you were in retail, and then from retail, you decided to follow your mum and step into accountancy.
I did.
Like
I
when I
did.
was
I
reading
wanted
there, I
to
was
be
speaking.
nothing.
Pardon?
It was one of those ones where you want to win your mum's approval. Absolutely right. I want, deep down, I wanted it. I knew that I could live without it, but I wanted it. Any teenager, you kind of want your mum's approval back. And so I followed in her footsteps. I thought to myself, you know what? Mum's done pretty well for herself. Retail's not going to get me to where I want to go. I didn't have a clue, really. I did, but I didn't know how to do it. I knew that I wanted to work with people, but I didn't know how in the capacity that I wanted to. So I thought, let me just follow in mum's footsteps and make her proud. And not only that, get a good income for me and my son and a good foundation set. So I started in admin first, then I started to get into purchase ledger, which is controlling the money that a company spends, and then credit control, placing debtors. So you see in both sides of the coin, and then become the accounts assistant. But what I did was make sure I went that step further, because when I became pregnant, I was an actual uni dropout, and I think that was my mum's absolute bugbear. She couldn't stand the fact that she put me into a private school. Imagine that. Get the results, go to a good uni, and then I'm pregnant and I become a uni dropout. So in a way, I could relate. And being someone that's kind of used to putting other people above and other people's feelings and their kind of needs above my own, I could relate to it. Even though I was in the position and it was impacting me, it was affecting me in the moment, I could actually relate to my mom and think, actually, step into her shoes. She's invested. I mean, I didn't get half a scholarship, I can't lie, doing sports, but other than that, she invested, in a private school for me. I've got the results, I do all of this, and then in her mind, I've thrown it all away. So I thought, let me get into accounts. So I did. I went back to university. I got my degree. Put my son in with my auntie. The relationship between me and my mom, it wasn't one that I could ask her to babysit. It wasn't that. It was she didn't her statement was, I didn't ask to be a grandma, so you can't make me into one. Ooh. And she's right. What can I say to that? She's right. It's her decision. So I then relied on my auntie. My auntie would have my son, and I would study and study and study until I made sure I got that scroll. And I invited her, and she was, I'll be honest, she was late. And my nan was there, which was the main thing. My nan was there. And I'll tell you something, so far. You see the picture I've got with my scroll, because that's what everyone wants. You want the scroll, you want to say, I did this. You want to put that up in the house and have that picture there on the mantelpiece. And I'll tell you something, I've got one with my nan, and honestly, her smile, it's like it's her graduation. She's wearing a black and pink huge hat with a matching dress, black and pink, with a trail, and she's holding the scroll like it's her graduation. She looks so proud. You know what? That was enough. That's what I needed. And yeah, my nan came through, man. So it was all good. It was all good. So I used that qualification, landed a really good job in accounts, was on good money, and from the outside, my life seems set. I've got my son, I've got my home, I've got the degree, I've got the job, I'm driving. You made it to some degree. You've got out of that hole that I was in. And so, yeah, life seemed great at that point, up until it
What was missing?
wasn't.
Because you sound like you've got everything any Tom, Dick, and Harry would want. Everything is made up for you perfectly. What was actually missing?
What was missing was fulfilling the my own purpose, fulfilling the, answering the call. I was getting this call. I had the niggle for a long time, and I would ignore it. It's a bit like an alarm bell going off, and you just learn to turn it off, override, press override, put it on snooze, until a point when I couldn't do it anymore. And so work became, I'd been there for 3 years, great company, great relationships I had with the top accountant and quite a few of the team there. And I just realized that I'm living someone else's dream. What does Avril want to do? And it was something completely different. Like, numbers are great, numbers are great, but people are more, great, than numbers. I loved people. And to be honest, I was always that go-to person in the family for like advice, guidance, support. I'd always been that, and I love, providing that support. But I didn't know how to do that on a major scale. I wanted to save the world. That's what I wanted to. I had an S on my chest. I wanted to get out there and save the world. And so I didn't know how to. But then it came to me that I needed to quit my job, really dig down and deep within myself and figure it out. And it took me a while to do that. I remember being, I've shared this before, but I remember being on a boat in Greece when it really hit me that I've got to do something about this. I couldn't carry on at work at all. When your soul's being destroyed, the more and more you go there.
Oh, I
And
know it.
like, I'm just, it's just soul destroying after a while, like you just can't carry on. I would have visions at work of just people come alive, thrive, really achieving their goals. And I would live in that. I would live in that moment every day, creating these amazing visions and thinking, oh my gosh, this is where I need to be. To the point where I told them, I'm going to leave. I'm going to leave. I'm going to give you 8 weeks' notice and I'm going to inspire the world to achieve success. And he said, Avril, it's the middle of the recession. You're barking mad. We need you. And I knew that if I didn't take a chance then, I wouldn't. I was 25 then. And I thought I would never take a chance. So I answered the call. So I answered the call, you know, and that was difficult to do because this had been ringing for so long. But I answered, and I'm pleased that I did.
The world is pleased that you did. And listening to you describe that story just reminds me of so many people who are living out dreams that isn't theirs. It's the dreams of their parents or their friends, or they're doing stuff because the culture around them kind of says it. There's this quote that I used to hold on to when I was in corporate from Thomas Merton. It was like, people must spend their whole lives climbing ladders of success only to find out once they reach the top, the ladder's leaning against the wrong wall. And I had that on my screen at work, and it just stayed in my mind over and over again. It's like, you're getting higher and higher and higher, but is this what you really want to do? And it's always that when you make that choice and that decision where, like you did, and you went in work, like, I'm going to do this. And they were like, you're crazy. And you're kind of like, that's not what I want to hear. But at the same time, you can understand why so many people who don't lean into it, who don't follow their dreams, feel that way. But you having that, listen to that call and making that choice and that decision, I can only imagine, like, it's not easy. You still got your son to look after. You got all the different environmental things around you. But you're like, I have to listen to myself. I have to be true to myself. And that, if I do that, that's going to make the massive difference and I can figure the rest out. That's such a powerful thing and courageous thing to lean into.
Yeah. That's the one. I can figure it out. And I didn't have all the answers at that time. I really didn't. But I knew I couldn't carry on with this. I knew something had to give, something had to change. So...
what was the first thing you did afterwards?
Oh, so afterward, I'd saved up a bit of money. You know, I saved up about $7,000 thinking I was rich. I was like, yeah, I'm good. So I, after that, I'd started writing programs. And I'll be honest, I was coming out of a toxic relationship just psychologically. And I really needed empowerment myself, to be honest with you. And I remember to the doctors, I was like, you know, I really need, I'm feeling a bit low, all of this kind of thing. And they were like, yeah, there's a course coming up, da, 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 da. And they told me, like, in a year's time, I was like, no, I'm going to write one. So I started writing programs, and it was for myself originally, because that's what I actually needed. I needed some empowerment at that time. And not often do I get a chance to share this, so I really appreciate it. So I started writing programs. And I started with self-belief. I needed some of that. I felt after not having work for about 6 weeks, you start to feel like a bum. You know, when you're used to going to work, getting up, going to work, if that routine is now broken, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing? And I couldn't quite work out what my routine was. So I felt like a bum. So that was also getting me down, as well as coming out of this relationship. And I thought, I need some guidance. I need to know. And so I started writing programs. And what happened was, it's going to sound crazy, but I put pen to paper and it was like an energy flew right down my arm and had written a program literally in 2.5 hours. It was a structured program. I've never written a program in my life, you know. And here we are, all the, you know, the self-help guru that I was at this time and still am came into play. You know, I'd written different modules. There were 7 modules at the time, and I'd written all the content for it, all the resources, everything you could think of. It was just there. And I thought, wow, I've got something here. And the more I trust it on us, what we say as coaches, the more we try it on ourselves, the more I thought, oh my God, this is working. Let me see if it can support others. So I started writing, designing leaflets, and they were just called empowerment sessions, color paper leaflets. And I'd just go around to different places that had a lot of foot flow. Didn't matter where, didn't care. You know, I've got a lot of confidence within me. When I believe in something, that is it. Like, that is it. So I would go to places like One Star. I'd go to places like Soho Road, Villa Road. And to me, places where there was a lot of foot flow, where I thought there was a lot of potential, but perhaps, untapped. How do I support them to tap into that potential? How do I empower? How do I support? So I thought, okay, I'm just going to go there and literally speak to people. That is it. I didn't have a plan. That is it. I'm going to speak to people. I've got something that can support them. Let's see if it does. And that gave me that drive, supporting others. I just had this drive. Like, I really believe in people. So I thought, okay, I'm going to go out there. So I did. I just stopped Shoppers and I said, excuse me, are you achieving your full potential? And they were just like, who are you? I said, listen, you've got everything to gain and nothing to lose. And I start to literally convince them to come onto the first session free of charge. It wasn't about money. It really wasn't. It was literally, can we make a difference? Is this valuable? And if so, what kind of value does it give? Does it provide? And after piloting in the community, I literally convinced four people, wasn't a lot, to come on to the first session. They came on, started talking to others, and I had full courses in community centres across Birmingham. And yeah, like we had fantastic outcomes as what we know it to be now. People were really achieving their visions. They were, a lot of them were in jobs, for instance, and they wanted to become self-employed or have a little side hustle, a little self-employed business on the side, all legal. And they would literally create that. There was like a housing officer that's got a run and run with therapy business on the side. There were lots of people that were achieving their vision. So this was actually working. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is great. And that would give me life. That would fuel me up for the next course. But then, you do this and you do this for free and you end up broke, which is what happened
It's
to me.
like, you know, it's good to make an impact. It's like, but you got a family to look after. Like, how are you paying your bills?
Exactly. Exactly. I found out the hard way. That happens a lot with me. I find out the hard way. Unfortunately.
When you see the
I
impact that
learned it.
you're making, though, you're inspired and be like, you know what? I said I'm gonna do something. I had a vision. I wrote it down. I built something. People are getting value from it. When did you then think, you know what? I could actually charge for this and make money for this? Because there are also a lot of people who have amazing visions, but they get scared when it comes to actually monetizing. They get scared to actually take that next step, even though they have to, but they get scared to. So how did you make that leap from the free to the people going to pay me for this?
You know what? When I became broke, yeah. So when I became broke, literally, when I realized that actually, Avril, you've got a really big heart, but at the same time, you need to get paid. It really hit me. So I remember rolling up, fried dumpling and beans that did as well for a long time. Noodle, things like that. I learned how to really just live on a budget. And I thought, this isn't living, I'm giving value and I'm not getting value back. And a lot of us, as you said, don't tend to know how to charge. And I was one of them, I think to myself, how do you charge an individual? I'm used to charging companies, businesses, B2C, not, sorry, B2B, not B2C. And so, and not only that, the people that I was supporting, I didn't think they could afford it, I'll be honest. And I thought, how can I? Yeah, I couldn't look in their eye and charge them £1,500. I couldn't do that. So I thought, well, let me go to institutions where they, these people would be, where they have cohorts of groups, like this that would need this kind of support. So these are, people that may lack confidence, have a lot of potential, maybe, marginalized communities, that kind of thing. And I thought, okay, I went to different schools, colleges, universities. And I would get paid. I thought to myself, what can I charge for this? What is the value? So I just charged more workshop, structure, kind of pricing structure. And then I then became, after that was working really, really well, I thought to myself, I really believe in people. I became a coach, not only a life coach, but I also became a change work specialist, like an NLP practitioner. So it meant that a lot of the work and a lot of the transformational aspects of the program, we're doing it on purpose. So we are about changing lives from the language. Straight away we're talking about the language patterns that we're using, all of that, to ensure that people are in the right state of mind to be able to receive this information, and that we're going to support, help them to transform in whatever situation it would be. But a lot of the time, it would be young people that are, at risk. So, and this is at risk of violence, at risk of all sorts. So, we would deliver. I would deliver these programs in schools, colleges, universities, and then someone said to me, "Why don't you do it in a prison?" I'd give out feedback forms, and they were like, "Why don't you do it in a prison?" And I thought, "Oh my gosh, I love a challenge." And if you know me, a lot of business people love it. Come on now, come on now. We
It's a
thrive on that
prison, though. I
stuff. We
mean,
love that.
if someone comes to me like going this and working in prison, I'm not gonna think I love a challenge. I'm like, it's a prison. Like
When you put it like that, but he's a prisoner. That is hilarious. It didn't stop me, I just saw a prison as, and I still do. It's just a place where there's honestly so much untapped potential, but there really is. It's like a big community center full of people that need guidance. They really do. And if we don't guide them, they're just going to continue wasting their lives. How do we guide them? How do we have them answer the call? A lot of them are having these calls. They're human beings at the end of the day. They need guidance. Where are they going to get it from? So I thought, this is a big challenge for me. This is what I want to do. So I then started to really focus on the criminal justice sector, learn about the prison industry, and then decide what my first prison was going to be, and also what the outcomes were going to look like. It isn't just me just making people feel good for a day. What is the outcomes, and is that going to be lasting? Is it going to be sustainable change? Because if you know me, if we're not making a difference in terms of a measurable difference and sustainable change or lasting change, then count me out. I'm here to make a difference. So I wanted to be able to measure that as well. So we do a lot of impact reports. So I started off at H&P Huon in Redditch. It was an open prison, a Cat D, and this is where a lot of the people there are given trust. They can go on work placements, ROTL, release on temporary license. They're in dormitories, not necessarily cells. They can move around freely. That's an open prison. They're given a lot more opportunity, but as soon as they jeopardize that opportunity any kind of way, they'll be shipped straight back into closed conditions now. So that's an open prison. So that was the first one I went to, and I went there and I said, "Listen, here's a fantastic course. I've already piloted it in the community. Here are the results it can bring you." And I said, "You'll see a difference in their attitude towards their peers and staff. You'll see a difference in violence towards peers and staff.
Who are you, who,
You will see a difference
I'm
in
gonna ask, who are you speaking to? Was it the warden?
No, so they don't have much power. No, it's not the warden. It's going to be the head of reduce. Sorry, head of reducing reoffending. That's right, head of reducing reoffending, or the head of learning and skills. Yeah, so I'd get these contacts, and I'd literally be emailing them, and then I went on this course. It was prison. It was called Prison Link, with Ricky Dehaney, and I went on this course, and they. One of the modules is to go on a prison visit, and it was to the same prison. This is before I went to the prison, sorry. I got their contact details, so I knew who to approach. So when I did, approach them, I knew exactly who I was approaching. I told them what this course can actually do, what outcomes they would see and what they would have and what they could measure in what time frames. And they said, "Prove it." And I said, "Happily. Happily, this is my world. This is what I do. This is what I do." Yeah. So thinking, then I know who I am. Like, this is what I do. You know what I mean? So as soon as you open that door for me, that's it. I'll open that wide open. So it wasn't, again, it wasn't about the money. I knew that would come, and I knew that would come. So I said, when it gives you these outcomes, not if, but when, pay me. I said, the first one I'm happy to give you for free, but when it gives you these outcomes, they said, deal. I said, brilliant. And I delivered in that prison, and they set me up to fail, I'll be honest. They put me in competition with the association time, which, those that know will be the gym. So you could either go to the gym or go to this program. A lot of them pick the gym, let's be honest. But I would turn up with my happy-go-lucky self in the canteen and say, "Hi guys, how you doing?" And they'll be like, "What? Like, who are you? And what are you here for, miss? What are you here for?" And don't worry about that. I said, "Listen, I've got this fantastic program." I said, "This is a gift. That's what this is. This is a gift. Grab it with two hands." And I said, "Just come to this session, 6 till 9, on a Wednesday. Sorry, on a Friday, and go from there." I said, if you enjoy it, tell people." And they were like, okay. So a few of them came up for different reasons, to be nosy and see what I'm about, but I'd be honest, I set the premise straight away. I said, "If I'm giving you my respect, where's mine?" And as soon as I said that, they were like, "Oh, Miss ain't playing. She ain't playing. She ain't play." No, she's not. Okay, we're here for the right reasons. Yeah, and if you're not, then you know where you can go back to. Yeah, so I'd keep it very real with them. There's no beating around the bush. I'll talk to them very straight, and they appreciate that. We'd have those straight conversations, and I'll teach them success principles, and we'll go for that program. So this program was really about self-belief, having them believe in themselves again. When you've say committed crime, sometimes you take on that negative stigma which is placed upon you by society, and you can really take that on as your own perception of yourself, and that can be quite a spiraling place to be, so it's about really having them really believe in themselves again, which is really important. So that's module one. Then it goes into values, like what is really important to you. And that can be different things for a lot of them. Then it's like identity, which I think is just huge. How do you see yourself, and what impact do you want to have in this world, and then goal setting. What is it you want to achieve? What is your vision? And then we'll go into what's stopping you. Is it the conviction? Is it that you left school with nothing? We'll go into those limiting beliefs. What is it that's holding you back? Then we'll go into how do you take action? What does that look like? Who do you need to speak to? How do you create those networks? And then resilience. How do you keep it? I always say to the guys, you can get the girl, but can you keep her? The hard work isn't about getting the girl, because I know you can do that, but can you keep her? And they'll all laugh, but they know it's true, because that's the sustainability aspect of it, which is the resilience, and the discipline. So that is the program, and that's what we delivered in the prison. And yeah, we surpassed expectation, exactly what I said. We exceeded expectations, and so we were paid. I became an organization, and we started to get paid. So yeah, that was the journey.
When I listen to you describe that program, I listen to you describe you. I listen to you describe your journey and the steps that you had to go through for yourself to get to the point where you were to overcome the different things that you had gone through to step away from the accountancy role to start to do this and then start to create and landing in the prisons. And it's interesting when I heard that, I'm like, naturally people think like, oh, prison setting, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, actually, you know what? It doesn't matter what setting or environment you're in. There are a lot of people who are in their own settings of so-called prisons who are navigating their own challenges. They just have to happen to be in physical prisons for different things. But actually, fundamentals of what you're teaching them is about life, like how you thinking about life. How do you have the right identity, mindset, language, and all those different elements and stuff like that. The foundations of who we are as humans, which along the way, so many of us lose, and you're helping them reconnect back to that so they have a clear path. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is Avril's journey just dispelled to me in a way, in a language that means so much to them.
Do you know what? It's a really good point, and I think it's only recently I've really thought about it being the same thing in terms of, as I said, that program was for myself at that time, and then realizing it could help me, it could help others. So absolutely, it was timely, and I just knew that this can support others, and so it did. So I think it is a representation of me. I think it is, and my belief in others, it definitely is, and a gift. As I said, it's a gift.
A
Gift for the
gift, that's a
world.
gift. And you went from one to how many now?
Sorry, what was that?
You went from one prison to how many are you now working with?
Oh, listen. Oh gosh, 36. There's 36 prisons across the UK. Yeah,
That's
36 prisons across
incredible.
the UK. I know. It's... Thank you. Every prison's very different in how they, and the regime's the same in terms of the timings, but how they operate, especially if it's a public or private prison, very different. But yeah, you learn a lot. I've learned so much from the people that I meet. You'd think, what would you learn in a prison? But when people tell you their stories, now because of what you've said, a lot of people, outside of prison can be imprisoned in their own mind, So how can you support them to release, themselves from this prison? It doesn't matter where you reside, whether you actually be in a physical prison or not. It's what's happening up here, as we know. That's the most important part. So yeah, I think in these prisons, you learn so much, you hear their stories, and I think it's an honor. It's an absolute honor for someone at a point of crisis to tell you their journey and tell you their story. It's a vulnerable, place in a position that, for them, but they allow you to be a part of it. And I think that's really special. And when you hear people's stories, I feel like I've experienced so many things, so okay, like as in, I've lived it vicariously through them because they've told me their thoughts and feelings through every aspect of their journeys, whether it be, the robbery. I've heard it all. I've literally heard it all. And so listening to their stories, you learn vicariously, you really do. So if ever, any of those kind of thoughts ever were to come up, I think, oh no, I've been there, I've done that. No. And don't get me wrong, they don't, but I'm just saying, like, you learn so much about it, that those things would never come up for me, anymore, having heard any of these stories. Even if you just think, what would happen if I'd be curious? No. You learn from them, and you've lived it. You've literally lived it. So it's really important that you listen. And when listening, when you do listen, you can then obviously guide them once you know exactly how they've, as we say in NLP, coded that experience. How have they thought about and really how they've perceived their own experience, and what that means to them now. And therefore, what does it mean to them going forward? So it's really important. You meet them at a turning point, and it's such a critical moment, such a window of opportunity when you're speaking to them in the segregation unit or, within the education department or within the multi-faith room. These moments, these exchanges are powerful.
So did that 36 prisons working internally, you then create new programs externally, working with people who are leaving ex-offenders to create something different, but to give them a whole new lease of life once you're outside the confines of those four walls, just to grow, have sustaining jobs and different things like that. It's like an extension of what the work you started internally, externally, or would you say they're two separate things?
I think it's an extension. I think you've put it perfectly. It is an extension because they have different challenges once released. It's a massive adjustment going through, closed conditions to open conditions, and then actually being part of the community again, part of society again. It's a massive transition, and so they're going through different challenges, and we need to just be aware of what challenges they're going through at each stage. So it's basically set up for them to really thrive on the out, as we say, or in the community, being a member of our community. And they need to not forget that they are a member of our community, even though they've committed a crime. And this is really important to say, even though they've committed a crime, it doesn't define them. It's a behavior. They are not their conviction. And so they can define who they are in their future. They get to do that, and it's important that they do. So on the outs, we work with different statutory services and public services, like probation, youth probation, youth justice service. We work with DWP. A lot of them are on universal credits, and they get referred to us to go onto our programs. And this really supports them to, again, some of it's an extension, as you said. So we will kind of do a recap of the self-belief aspect, that kind of thing, the readjustment in terms of rekindling relationships with family members, significant others, that type of a thing, because they're now on the out, they need that connection. because it's very easy for them to literally, go back into what they know. If they don't have that support system network, what does that look like for each person? It could be different. It could be that their family disowned them, being released. A lot of people have different situations when they come out that we need to be aware of. And so then we think about, well, what's their vision? What do they say they wanted to do? And how can we support them on the out in the community to achieve that? So what kind of job is that? How can we link them up with those kinds of employers? Or is it that they need some work experience? Or is it that they want to actually become self-employed and be their own boss? Because a lot of these people are sometimes better suited to be their own boss because they don't like authority, a lot of them. So how can we support them, to create those kinds of career pathways for themselves? And we also can provide them with grants. £1,500 startup grant as well to support them. So yeah, this is the kind of work that we do on the out to really set them up for sustainable success, career success. How can we link them to opportunity, not just empower them and make them feel good, but how can we also make that connection between where they are to an actual opportunity that can be sustainable for them to provide for themselves and their families? I'm very much about impact, and this is what impact is. We want to see them actually transform their lives, that they can be proud of themselves and actually provide for themselves sustainably and their loved ones.
When you go back to you at your accountancy desk, scribbling down your vision and to where you are right now, is this what you set out to do and build and achieve, or is this just chapter one and there's a lot more to come?
I'm so glad you said that. It's chapter one, and there's a lot more to come. Definitely. I've never thought this is the end result. No, I've never even thought I'd specialize in, those with convictions in any kind of a way. I never thought that would be one of our main cohorts ever. To me, people are people, and as I said, it doesn't matter where they reside, it doesn't matter what they've done, it doesn't matter what their past has been, their future is spotless. And we can support them, to really create from that canvas what is it you want to achieve. So it doesn't really matter what their past has been. So to me, there's so many people out there, with conviction, without conviction, that need support with creating what that vision looks like and how can they achieve it. And that could be working people. It doesn't really matter. So I don't want to limit, what we do to just these cohorts, but I do think we've learned a significant amount from working with these cohorts. And I think it's been an absolute blessing and a pleasure working with these cohorts. Honestly, you learn so much, and they're just real people that need that guidance. These people can be your friend, your cousins. When you realize how much similarity there is, there's no separation because you know what? One decision or making a different decision at a certain specific point of your life, or taking two steps to the left and one behind, you could swap positions just like that. It can happen to anybody, and that's what people forget. Just having made the wrong decision or a decision in a moment of time can change your life just like that. And who's now going to support you? It can happen to anyone, and so you really do need to count your blessings when you're working with these cohorts and really think about, the privilege that you do have.
Something that you said earlier, and that's kind of stayed with me, and I want to go back and ask you the question. Just thinking about what you just talked about, the cohorts and people, you said you realized at 30 that you had been living with trauma. I was very curious as to what led to that revelation and how did it change and shift the way that you are approaching life and the work that you do once you had that realization as well.
Wow. So what an amazing question. I'm trying to think, what was it that actually made me realize I was living in a state of trauma and that became my norm? Like, I'm so used to battling. I'm so used to fighting, for whatever it is that I'm after, or what I'm looking for, what I want, or the goal that I'm trying to achieve. I'm so used to battling, and that's based on what I've my upbringing, for one, and two, around the trauma. I didn't realize how much of a challenge it was not having that direct support system as a single parent from loved ones that you expected it from until you really need it and you think, hang on, other people have it. How come I don't? I was so tunnel vision in just trying to survive that once I'd learned to survive and now it's about thriving, I could actually pull back on the accelerator and actually think, look at my life and think, what's missing? And yeah, there was that kind of support system from a family, and particularly, yeah, it was my mother, that I didn't really have, and I think my son would have benefited more from, perhaps, you never know. But at the same time, it never bothered me before, or not consciously anyway. So as I got older, yeah, it came to light that actually that is important. So I had to really dive into that and see if I'm holding any bitterness. As you said, how is that possibly impacting me, my journey, my future? And I think it was, I'll be honest, I think it was. And so I had to really dive in and almost become my own therapist and think to yourself, if you step into that person's shoes, can you understand why they might have made those decisions? And I did, even though I've thought of this before, I really went there. I really went there. I stepped into that position and thought, how can someone make a decision like that? And it's such a detrimental one. And I realized, here's what I learned, and I think this is what really helped me to forgive, and I mean that forgive, is I learned that people are people, and you can't expect them to be who they are not. They are who they are. And who am I to tell someone who they should be? Just because I have my own expectations of them. Who am I? They are who they are, and that's who they've chosen to be, and they're happy with that. What's that got to do with me? And so when I looked at it in that perspective, am I allowing people to be who they want to be? It wouldn't, it would be very, what's the word? It would go against what I really believe in and what my value system is and what I'm teaching others if I was to judge someone because they're not who I want them to be, And so I decided, stop being so judgmental. Yeah, it's not ideal, but be happy that she's happy with herself. Be happy that she's comfortable and that was the right decision that she made for herself, and that's who she's happy to be. And I tell you something, we've got the best relationship now.
Because you just accepted her for who she is.
Absolutely, that's who she wants to be. Absolutely, and I'm happy that she's happy. I genuinely am. I genuinely am. I'm happy that she's happy. It's nice to see her happy, and it's nothing to do with me. Stop making it about me, And so I had to really dig deep there. And you know what? I really would always protect my mum, no matter what. Anyone, I would protect my mum no matter what, who you are. Those things don't change. But it's nice to actually now take that cloud that I had there away and see her for who she really is. And you know what? It's beautiful. So I've come all the way through. And she did it for the right reasons, and I accept them.
This is also around once you get there, you also stop putting expectations in places where it shouldn't be, and therefore you can never be disappointed as well. So it's also about you and your journey and what boundaries you're willing to create, what you know you're going to get and not get, and therefore that hurt kind of just starts to dissipate. slowly because you're accepting, like, this is who they are, this is what they're going to do. I know that now. So therefore, I cannot expect anything more.
That's it. That's it. The expectation. And I think as well, you know, a lot of our parents have been through their own challenges, you know, growing up. And that's something they don't even speak on. Some they do, some they don't. A lot of the time they don't. But a lot of the times you can pick up on kind of what they might have gone through if they, you know, they're not actually openly sharing it. And so I've had to really think from that perspective as well. What has my mom got? You know, what experience has she had that's made her who she is today? And that's protected her, for her to be comfortable with who she is. And that's great. You know, so I think we also have to think of that a little bit further. Like, she was a child once, you know, and she's gone through her own challenges, which has made her become who she is today, and that she's happy with, and that's okay. That is okay. So yeah, you have to kind of think beyond yourself, which is sometimes hard for us to do.
And then when do you, or when did you in particular, stop putting other people's feelings above yours? And when did you recognize that actually how you feel is important and should actually be prioritized, as opposed to just always thinking consistently about other people?
Oh, I'm still learning that now. I can't lie. I'm still learning that now. So I can't say I've mastered that. I'll be honest. It's a hard one. You're so used to serving, you know, and being of service, and being a bit of an empath. You know, when I'm around people, I do pick up on how they feel. Sometimes when it's not even spoken, you know, I can pick it up, and therefore, like, what do I do with that? You know, I can either support them through it, or, you know, be a friend, or be, you know, be someone that can, you know, be of assistance of some kind, or completely, you know, create a healthy boundary, you know, which is something I'm learning to do sometimes. So I don't need to always be superwoman in every situation, you know, and it can take from your own journey, it can. So I'm still learning it. I think being an empath is difficult because you do need to try and learn to switch it off, but it is hard. It is hard. That is a gift and a curse for me, especially in the work that I do. It really is. But in terms of just in general, putting people first, yeah, I'm every situation, I'm not going to lie, it's actually the work I'm actually doing now. You know, we're constantly learning. The work I'm doing right now, not afraid to say, is I'm in every moment where I feel like, you know, this is a situation where I could actually be prioritizing myself, I have to actually ask the question, am I listening to myself, or am I trying to please others? You know, these are the type of questions that I'm having to ask myself in the moment. You know, am I pleasing myself, or am I trying to please others? But that kind of a question, and answering it in the moment, and then doing the right thing in the moment, and just making sure you're trusting that gut that comes up, because your gut works, you know, we're all connected. And when that gut fires up and gives you that, you know, that alert, am I listening, or am I just, again, pressing override? Am I overriding? So yeah, I think I'm just learning more to listen to my gut the first time, and then being able to make sure I'm tending to my own needs as a priority, because I'm human just like everybody else, and I have needs too, personally and professionally. And so, yeah, I think it's one of those things that I've kind of learned a bit, possibly not too late, but quite late. But I think it's served me to get to where I am right now. But definitely, I think the future looks quite different in terms of my journey. I think it does. And I'm really excited to see how that pans out, and what, you know, is revealed on that journey. So
I'm excited to see it as well. And you're so right. And there's so many people that I've personally experienced, and people I've spoken to as well, where it's like there is a part of your life that takes you to a particular point. So whether it is the trauma, the vision, whatever that might look like, it gets you to a point where you're like, okay, cool, this has served me up until this point. This next part of my life, I no longer want to use that as the fuel to drive me. I want a different version of me to emerge and step forward. And that unlearning and letting go of that old self into that new self is a journey that we all go through. But when you get to that point, you're like, no, I want this. It looks and feels, and you start to move so much more differently. Whereas, like, people are like, rah, like, what happened to you? kind of thing. Yeah, but it's like, yeah. No, it's just the reemergence of who you are. You're stepping into that next level as you're growing. And there are times where people, like it and the times when people don't. But actually, it's just the next evolution of us. And that's how we should be consistently growing. So I'm very excited to see, like, if that's what you have done, created, that's the impact you've made so far with that version of you, the next version is just going to be, like, even more so, like, incredible. But fundamentally, your foundation doesn't change, which is around how do you keep on impacting the lives of people? Like, that common thread all the way from when you were young to where you're right now has never just gone away, and it's not going to go away. But it's just how you do that and supersede that in more spaces and places, which is why it's always like, everyone talks about, I'm like, listen, you need to watch what Avril's doing. Because, like, this is someone who had a vision that seemed absolutely crazy. I told you when last spoke, I'm like, the name of your company, I've never seen such a perfect name for someone. Like, you had a vision, you stepped into it, and, like, that was like a leap of faith. But even now, listening to you describing it, I was like, all right, this is a playbook for someone who's thinking, I want to do something. And you literally went to, like, okay, you validate the idea, you find paying clients, you do research if you want to go for bigger spaces, and then you pitch an offer that aligns to them. And then you have to be prepared to be resilient, because you're going to get a lot of knockbacks and no's. But if you eventually get in there, do what you're doing, back your talk. And if you can do that, you keep on building and growing. That's a blueprint to how you make a vision come alive. And it's not easy. It takes time and effort and energy, and there are bumps along the road. But you're doing it. You're living out that vision. And it's amazing to see and be witness and to share with the world as well.
Ah, thanks, Dolpe. Well, the way you've just actually summed that all up is amazing. Like, honestly, the way you've analyzed the journey, even more so than I have, like, I'm so impressed. And the way you just, like, wrap that up in, like, a few seconds, I'm just so impressed, because you've got it. You've absolutely got it. I'm looking forward to what's next, definitely. But using, you know, all that I've learned along the way, but also not forgetting the foundation. Like, it doesn't change. It just looks a little bit different. To reach more and more people and become more, and for me to become more. So I'm looking forward to what that actually will look like. But it's being curated at the moment.
What is the best way that people can support you, get involved with you as you are still doing what you're doing now, but also moving to that next level?
That's a great question. I think just follow us at the moment. A lot of our services are public services. Does that even make sense? Sorry. A lot of our services are in public settings, statutory settings at the moment. So it can be a little bit tricky in that respect, unless you're in those settings. But I'd just say follow us at the moment, because a lot more is being opened up. Yeah, and new programs are being birthed. So yeah, follow us at the moment is what all I would say. I'd say mainly LinkedIn is going to be the best bet. We're on all of the different social platforms, but I'd say LinkedIn, we're definitely quite frequently posting on LinkedIn.
About time. I'm going to add that, about time.
Yeah. I'll be honest, I'm so doing the work, I forget to post, and we need to do it a lot more. There's so much success stories that we've got that we haven't posted yet. There's loads to come. So do follow us. There's a lot of work that we're doing. And I think a lot of the media push out so much negativity in this context, but there's a lot of positive that is happening and taking place. So we want to be able to showcase that more. So please, yeah, stay in touch. Follow us. And yeah, come on the journey with us. Come on the journey and have a look at some of these lives that are being changed. And just one more thing to say, which I haven't mentioned. We've also got a therapeutic service. I don't think I've described this before. We've had it for 5 years now. And what this looks like, we lead with cultural competence. And so all our therapists are multicultural, you know, reflecting the multicultural city that we live in, and West Midlands wide. A lot of them are serving and delivering therapy on a one-to-one basis, mainly in Birmingham, Wolverhampton, Coventry, and Dudley. But this is something we definitely want to expand upon. And this is for a lot of young people, again, that have experienced any kind of, or impacted by youth violence. we specialize in that particular area, but this is something we're growing as well. But what I love about this is that a lot of our therapists are bilingual, so they speak lots of different language, because that cultural familiarity is really important, because the Eurocentric approach isn't for everybody. And so we create safe spaces for young people to be able to share their thoughts and feelings. A lot of them are exposed to a lot of youth violence and, you know, their friendship groups, all of that. Who do they speak to about these kinds of things? Because they're not talking to parents anymore as much. So once parents sometimes, you know, are lost in those kind of conversations of what's happening with their children, who are they speaking to? So we create safe spaces where young people can talk and release some of that emotion, so that they can have more mind space to think about aspiration. So that's the kind of work that we're doing. We've been doing it for 5 years now. So that's something else that we're expanding upon. And I thought it was important to mention as well, because even though I'm a coach, I think, yeah, therapy is definitely a big part of the journey, especially the starting place in terms of trauma. And then we get into coaching, which is obviously a lot of the change work around it afterwards. So, yeah, we were creating that ecosystem. But let me stop there, because I can go on about what the future could look like. And yeah, follow us. That will stop you from following. Yeah, follow us instead. That's the best thing to do.
Definitely. And all the information around A-Vision, Avril, will be available in the show notes. And just from the journey she shared, this is someone who is dedicated to bringing out the greatness in people consistently in every single way, shape or form. And there's no one left behind. I'm going to say no man, but there's no one left behind whatsoever. And that vision is coming to light in so many different areas, from the therapy to the prisons to ex-offenders. And it's just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. So definitely 100% support the work that she's doing, because we definitely need more people like her and her company in the world that we're living in. So thank you very much for just coming on and just sharing your journey and just sharing a snippet of your story. It's been absolutely amazing.
Oh, thank you. It's been absolutely so enjoyable to have this conversation, and just in the way in which you interview as well, it's just wonderful. It's just like such a breeze. It's a lovely conversation. Thank you for allowing me to just share more of me in the world and more of what we're doing. I really appreciate you. Thank you so much, Sophie.
It's an absolute pleasure. This is Everyday Leadership. We'll see you all next week.